Blog Talk Radio.
Every author has that one story that hits close to home for them. This is Yvonne Mason's.
This book is very personal to me.
The 50s has been idealized as a time of prosperity and growth for some. Those with mental and physical challenges often faced scorn and ridicule, and were destined to be left in so-called hospitals to wither and die. Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, is the uplifting story of a man named Stan and his family's courage to defy the odds and succeed in an era where no merit was seen in the challenged.
It is the true story of my brother who was mentally and physically challenged. It is because of my brother Stan that I am a successful author.
Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, is available through Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason, and yes, Guilty, that was a shameless piece of advertisement for my book, Dreamcatcher Was Never an Option, and it is about my brother who's mentally and physically challenged, and he gets all the credit for where I am today. It is because of him that I am not only a successful author, but I am also a highly successful radio host. And if you were looking for ads, the young man that did that ad is phenomenal. His name is Chris Dunham, and he is on my Facebook page. He also runs his own radio show, but he is also a great ad master. He's very reasonable. He's also looking for sponsors for his show, so hook up with him because I'm telling you, you can't do any better than Chris Dunham. Now that the business of the evening is out of the way, tonight is Thursday night. And this has been a long, long awaited night for my guest and myself because I sadly had to postpone her debut show with me because we had to evacuate during Hurricane Matthew. My guest tonight is author Anne Goldfarb. She is a New York native who has spent most of her life in education, first as a classroom teacher and later as a middle school principal and professional staff developer in upstate New York. She has 9 published young adult time travel mysteries and over a decade of experience writing nonfiction for Jones Publishing and Matterhorn Media Trade magazines. Her time travel novels have garnered a number of awards and recognitions, including first place for The Time Borrower and the romance category from Feathered Quill Book Awards in 2015. She is a member of the Arizona Authors Association and has served as a judge for their literary contest. Welcome, my friend, after such a long journey of having to wait to get on this show.
Oh, thanks, Yvonne. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I tell you what, I have been waiting and waiting and waiting. I'm just so sorry that I couldn't get you on sooner after that debacle with Hurricane Matthew. Mother Nature likes to screw with us. I'm telling you, she has a wicked sense of humor.
Absolutely.
But let's. I read your bio, and then I read your synopsis of your books, and I'm going, that's interesting. It's really interesting how you take and weave basically history into time travel. So before we get into the books, how did you get from point A to point B and then go in the direction that you went in with your writing? To me, it's just fascinating as to how that happened.
Well, it was interesting to say the least. While I was a school principal, I started writing for trade magazines. And these were collector magazines, people who collected anything from Hummel figures to teddy bears, that sort of thing. And I enjoyed writing, and it gave me a venue that took me outside of education, gave me something else to think about, another part of my brain, so to speak. And I really enjoyed it. And I think the pinnacle came in 2008 when I flew to London to cover, of all things, a teddy bear show for Jones Publishing, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've died and gone to heaven. And I covered the show, the article came out in their magazine, I was thrilled, and shortly after that, they called and said, we hate to say this, but as you know, there's a recession going on, And we are just cutting our freelance writers, and our editorial staff will be doing the writing. It's been nice knowing you. Well, all of a sudden, I was out a wonderful sideline. And what happened was very simple. People stopped collecting things because there was no expendable cash. So I thought, you know, I'm just not going to worry about this. I've always wanted to write fiction. I've been a middle school principal for 16 years. I know my target audience. I know how kids think and act in all kinds of situations. I've certainly watched them enough. And I thought, you know, what if I were to write a story that would engage students and talk a little bit about time travel, which is also a passion of mine. So I decided I was going to buckle down and do that, did a lot of research about time travel, as the fictional part as well as the actual science behind the idea, and I wrote The Face Out of Time. And let me tell you, every mistake an author could make in writing a book, I made it with that book. And if there was a mistake they didn't make, Anne Goldfarb made it for them. It took me a few tries, but finally the book got published, and off I went. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, let me ask you this. There was a, if memory serves me, there was a book written by Jules Verne.
Oh.
I think. That had to do with time travel. Did he not write a book that had to do with time travel?
Well, I'm thinking H.G. Wells and the Time Machine.
Oh, that's what it was. You're right.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
absolutely right. I'm
yeah.
getting
H.G.
my author's
Wells. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was one of the classics. And you know, and interesting, you know, with that whole concept of time travel, there are so many possibilities, beginning with the how. How do you move through time? I mean, even fictionally. And, of course, time machines are really a good option if you can invent a time machine. In fact, there's a great TV series that just started called Timeless, and that's what they use, a time machine. And I thought, what do other authors use? Well, they use openings in time, formulas, black holes, sometimes magic, all sorts of things. And when I started writing, I began to use different venues as well until I came upon one that I absolutely loved, and that was Snell's Law of Refraction, which says, you know, unbended light can just go on indefinitely and move through time. And I thought, you know, take a little bit of science, a whole lot of fiction, and there you go. And that's when I started writing the series Light Riders, and my characters got the name Light Riders because they were riding on unbended light. And that series was just so much fun to pull off.
Well, what is it that interests you about the possibility, and who's to say the probability, of time travel? I know that many of us would say, well, if I could go back in time, I would do things differently. But I guarantee you, if we went back in time, we'd make the same dumbass mistakes.
Or change things. One little misstep in time, and that whole time-space continuum is altered. For me, it's kind of twofold. When I look at old pictures of people in the 1800s or the turn of the 20th century, any time really in time, I look and I think to myself, what would it be like to be there? What would I be seeing? What would I be feeling? What was life like? And as a writer, I'm able to pick places in time and go back and revisit them, of course, from the safety net of my own computer and my own desk. Then the science part of it, I do know from having read about time travel and the possibilities that gravity slows down time. So technically, when astronauts return from outer space, they're like a nanosecond or something like that ahead of time, and then time catches up with them. So the possibility of moving forward in time is there, but the possibility of moving backward in time, at least as far as I know, is still the fictional end and not the science part of it. But it's the fun part.
That's true. So I'm wondering if it would be safe to say, because, you know, our generation grew up on Lost in Space and
oh, yeah.
Star Trek and the black holes. So based on the science, would it be fair to say that there is a very big possibility that someone that we shoot off into space could go forward in time if they hit some of those black holes just right?
Well, some scientists think so. I'm certainly no expert. I leave my realm to the fictional part of it. But certainly from what I've seen about loops in space and black holes and, you know, that kind of thing, it's a possibility like anything else, I suppose. That's what makes it so fascinating. For an author to pick up time travel, there's so much they can do. They can look at it futuristically. They can look at it historically. Only one of my novels actually takes a leap into the future, and that's Time Tracer with World Castle Publishing. And in Time Tracer, my character actually traces a serial killer through time, and he winds up going ahead in time 30 years, and that's through a device that the killer has created. And that was really a challenge for me, because I left my safety net of historical fiction and branched out into a scientific thriller. And it was a lot of fun, but I have to say I feel much more grounded when I'm in the realm of historical fiction with time travel as a hook to bring my characters there.
Do you think that writing the young adult time travel books that take your characters as far back as to, I think, the 1700s, I think I read, that when they read these books, not only are they being entertained, Ann, but from a teaching perspective, they're also learning a bit about history. So that means you have to research. You have to do a lot of research of wherever you're going and whatever you're going to do in that time period, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And my characters, and in just the Light Rider series alone, my characters start out, they're 12 and 13, and they are cleaning out their great-great-aunt's hoarder's nest of a house and come across her formulas for time travel using prisms, bended light. And they say, you know, great-great-auntie Zane was just nuts. But they fiddle around and they say, yeah, what would happen if we did this? Well, the what would happen, they do it, and my characters get sucked back to the Great Depression in Arizona. Well, of course, I had to do a great deal of research. So that book encompasses not only the Great Depression, but the orphan train, the mining in Arizona, the United States Marshal Service, all sorts of things that I had to research, and it had to be spot on. So that was fun. And, of course, concepts like hoarding, because their great-great-aunt was a hoarder. So kids learned a great deal from that book. And I dare say this, all of my YA novels have study guides in the back, so I hope that doesn't scare any potential readers away. But once a teacher, always a teacher. So,
that is an excellent idea, because parents that are homeschooling their children, this would be a great read for them to use in their classrooms.
Oh,
especially
absolutely.
With study guides in the back.
Oh, and, you know, and I'm surprised when I talk to kids, because I do some workshops from time to time, I'm surprised that many of them haven't heard of the orphan train concepts, because there's so much now that is taking place in schools, and that's a whole subject unto itself, that there are areas that they're not familiar with. The next novel, when my characters are older, of course, when they get back from the Great Depression, they swear they'll never do it again. But, of course, when they're 14 and 15, what do? They wind up during the French Revolution in the Bastille. So, of course, I had to do a great deal of research on the French Revolution, the Bastille itself. I learned so much. It was a wonderful experience for me. And then the sequel took them into the Ice Age as well as the 1950s in Missouri. So they've been all over the place. And then I have a couple of spinoffs that take place in 13th century Scotland. And the other one takes place in what is now the island of Santorini, but then it was the island of Thera in the ancient Minoan culture. And let me tell you, that was a toughie to research, because the only information scholars have are on tablets known as Linear A and Linear B, but their artwork really was able to give scholars an idea of what life was like. So I used that as my basis when I wrote The Time Stealer. So, yes, to answer your question, absolutely, a lot of research.
Do you find that you yourself become, you know, we always think, well, I know history, I know this, I know that, but as we, as writers start researching, I know when I was in school and studying the Civil War, that was such a hard thing for me to learn. I guess I just closed my mind to it. But when I started researching the Civil War for my Civil War historical novel, things just roll out of my mouth now. I'm going, where did that come from? And it stayed with me when I researched that. Do you find that you learn and retain so much more things that you didn't, that you had not been told that were part of history, and some things that you had been told that were part of history were really false, that that wasn't the way it went down, but that was what was perpetrated in your history books?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I tell you, the biggest shocker for me, I studied for a year in Spain, and what we classified in all of our textbooks referred to it as the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Believe me, it wasn't known as that in Spain. And I realized people have a very different perspective of historical events, and we can see it in today's day and time. The interpretations of events differ widely. But for me, you know, in writing about characters, I have to base the books on what they're seeing, what they're feeling, who they are, and how they're reacting. And, of course, the storyline has to happen because although there's research and although it has to be accurate, certainly it's the telling of a tale. It's the creating of suspense and interest and, of course, the establishment of believable characters that hopefully readers will really enjoy and be rooting for one way or another.
And you weave the historical part into the story so that it flows seamlessly. And if a reader is reading that book, they should feel like they're actually in that part of history as an observer as to what's going on.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And for me, I've discovered that I really like using humor. And when I wrote a standalone novel called The Last Tag, it's about a 15-year-old graffiti tagger who stumbles on the remnants of an old murder in a house he breaks into, no less, in Scottsdale, and gets sucked back to 78 A.D. in the ancient Roman city of Herculaneum. Well, that was 1 year before Mount Vesuvius erupted, and he's got 1 year to solve the murder of a girl before that volcano erupts. And this character is, you know, he's no angel. I mean, we're talking a little graffiti tagger here. But somehow, when he gets back there, you find yourself rooting for him. And it's so believable. This is a kid who had very little Latin in school, but enough to get by. And he's taken on another identity. He's trying to keep his mouth shut and pick up what's going on. And definitely, you know, you feel as a reader that you're putting yourself in his place too. So yeah, that's the fun of it.
And you're right, because as writers, we tend to drop ourselves right in the middle of what we're writing. And I don't know about you, but I find myself lost in the maze of, okay, where is this character taking me now, and do I really want to go there? And I'm doing the writing.
Exactly. Well, for my character, you know, I can just have so much fun with it. He has to work like an old-time detective. You know, you have to interview people, try to track down who might have killed this girl. And, you know, he's going all over. And the one place the slaves say to him, well, you know, you're going to get a lot of information if you go to the baths, the Roman baths. And he's thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, I didn't even like swimming in the Y, and that was with a bathing suit on. Now I've got to go to these Roman baths with a bunch of naked people. And it's really quite comical. He hangs on to his towel and doesn't let go as he's trying to get some information. But definitely it's you live the part of the history from the point of view of your character, which is very different than picking up a history book and just reading, you know, events, times, places, and interpretations.
That is very true, because what what is listed in the history books is dry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, it's bare bones. It reminds me of a skeleton that has laid out in the desert too long. You touch it real softly, and it's just going to fall apart. There's nothing there of quote unquote interest. Of course, to those of us who study dead things, I would be interested. But when I was younger, it was boring. History was boring to me because there was nothing there that grabbed me. There was no who, what, when, where, or how. It was just,
oh, wow,
this is what happened.
Oh, gosh. And I really, you know, I really try hard to grab readers. And I think if they like what I'm writing, hopefully they'll pick up other books, you know, similar books or books that broach on the same topics and get a different perspective. That's so important. And there's so much out there for readers. But all it takes is one good book. Sometimes, you know, I would hear kids say, I don't like to read. And I'd say to them, that's because you haven't found the right book yet. Once you do, once you click with an author, you're going to enjoy it. And perhaps, you know, what you are being told to read in school, you know, obviously there's a reason for it. But if you have the choice, pick up an author that you might enjoy, even if you're starting with a graphic novel, nothing wrong with that, and go from there, and you'll find that you start enjoying it more and more. And we all have our favorites. I mean, there's some books that I've gravitated towards over the years, and others that I really haven't. And it's very different for all readers, but you've got to find the right thing that gets you started. That's for sure.
Well, speaking of getting someone started, there is a question that won't shut up, and it's niggling in the back of my mind. And if I don't ask it, I'm going to go insane.
Don't do that.
You, we aren't scripted here. It's why we're called Off the Chain. But I want to go back to the civilization that you only have the A and B linear tablets. That is just fascinating. Yes. How did you come across that? Why did you decide to use it? And where did it all blend into the book? I mean, these inquiring minds have to know.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when I wrote The Last Tag, which took place in ancient Rome, it was such a unique culture. We knew so much about the Romans and how they lived. And, of course, the Roman Empire stretched on for years and years and years. So the latter part of the Roman Empire was not the same as the beginning, but there was a lot there. But with the Minoans, that was sort of like the ancient Greeks, but they weren't the ancient Greeks. But a lot of people will refer to it as the ancient Greeks. What I knew about them were those pictures of the bull jumping, and you've probably seen them or renderings of them. It shows somebody grabbing the horns of a bull and throwing themselves over the bull. There was a lot of artwork about it and reference to it. So I thought, this is fascinating. I mean, I've seen bullfights in Spain. This is not a bullfight. This is bull jumping, very, very different. What kind of civilization does this? So I started to look into it, and I discovered that they were a civilization that had strange forms of recreation. They also practiced human sacrifice. They had trained, looked like trained dolphins, although, you know, I find that hard to believe. But it was, you know, this was all depicted. And, of course, the artwork just seemed to reiterate the same themes over and over again. So I put it all together, and I thought, you know, let me see what I can do with it. And what I did was I created a character, a 14-year-old kid named Wendell Tyler Banton, who is absolutely horrible, and he steals his teacher's formulas for time travel because he's searching for the lost civilization of Atlantis. But unfortunately, he winds up in Thera, ancient Minoa, and she's got to go back and rescue him. And believe it or not, in all of this, I have a very acerbic sense of humor. It's a comedy, and it just moves from one element to the next, and it's quite funny. But again, this woman is trying to save this kid, and no matter what she does, he louses it up. So it's quite interesting. But I'm always looking at the puzzle and how I can put it together, as well as something unique and different, and that just caught my eye.
So this civilization, did it run parallel with the Greek civilization? Did it come after the Greek civilization?
Actually earlier, very, very early in time. It was a very early civilization. So that's probably why there isn't a whole lot of information that we can glean, but certainly an interesting one. And believe it or not, the language is very similar to the Greeks. For example, they actually have a word for ceremony of the bulls. And boy, I'm not going to pronounce this right, but it's Taurocapthanisia, which is the ceremony of the bulls. But this civilization thrived in the early part of the Bronze Age. So that's going way, way back in time. That's for sure.
What caused it to fall?
I don't know. Some people say a volcano exploded there, and the island became, you know, what's now that circular island of Santorini, and led people to believe it might have been Atlantis, but that's unsubstantiated. But the clay tablet, that Linear A, was discovered on the island of Crete at the turn of the 20th century. So this is, you know, we've only had this information for a short while in history, but it's very, very interesting. And a lot of speculation, that Atlantis theory, people speculate that a volcano erupted sometime between 1600 and 1627 B.C., and that's how they got that notion of the lost city of Atlantis. So hopefully that kind of explains it a little bit for you.
It does. I find it fascinating. And of course, now my brain's going in a tilt-a-whirl because it's going, you got to go see it. You got to go check it out. You got to go check it out. Because I'm a researcher about nature, and the brain just, sometimes it takes a walkabout on its own.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's so much fun researching everything. It really is. And for me, what's fun, too, is watching how the characters react, because these are 21st century characters forced to be living in another time, and it's interesting to see how they react. Even things like the foods that people eat, and you know, in fact, I'm sitting here and I'm kind of thumbing through as you're talking. And I came across a page talking about food and. This is my character, and this is what he says. This is Wendell, and he's writing, dried fish and yogurt for breakfast. No way to file a complaint with the culinary staff. It wouldn't matter. It wasn't as if I was going to be alive for another meal. The morning was spent with what I'd like to call special grooming and bathing. They're preparing him for sacrifice. Special grooming and bathing. I had only witnessed this type of reduction once in my life, and that's when we had to take Aunt Eleanor's Bichon to the doggy spa. So, you know, there's some humor in there. I mean, here's this kid that they're getting ready to sacrifice. So,
and he's still got
again,
twisted humor.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny, but it's serious, and you get to know, gosh, what was that civilization really, really like? And I get that way with all of the books that I write. I just totally immerse myself in that time and in that place. So it's quite interesting, so I'm certainly enjoying that.
One could say that the children of this generation, if all of a sudden the electrical grid and the telephone grid and the satellites all went dark,
uh-huh.
and they were forced to grow gardens and cook either on an old wooden cook stove or over an open fire baths after they went and gathered water out of the nearest creek bed, that they would definitely be in some time travel.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. You know, the things that we're used to that we take for granted, it's amazing. And this particular generation, my gosh, I look back and I think, how did I ever live without a microwave? My gosh. How did I ever live without a Keurig coffee maker?
How did we live without air conditioning? I grew up without air conditioning.
Oh, that's right.
In fact, I don't think
Florida. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm from Georgia, so it was just as bad. But we didn't have a television until I was 11, 12 years old.
Oh, my gosh. Now, we had a TV. It was an old black and white thing. But I know exactly what you're saying. And, in fact, years ago, my neighbor had to go away, and her son was going to – her little boy, he was about five, had to stay with some other people. And they told him, you know, the people you're staying with don't have a TV. And his response was, what? They don't have a television? You mean to tell me they just live? You know, the way he said it, you know, they just live. I mean, how can you possibly live without these amenities that we're so used to?
That we're so used to. Well, let me ask you this, my dear. We were talking about your preference in books versus others. Before I ask you what authors that you are currently into, have you found that your preference in books has evolved over the years?
Well, you know, I have to say I've always been what I would call an eclectic reader. I have certain genres that I like more than others, but then again, if a book is very well written, if the characters are crafted well, if the plot line moves me, if you know, there's so many reasons, I will enjoy a good Western as much as I will enjoy a good thriller or historical novel. So I'm all over the place. I tend to like gothic romance quite a bit, the Daphne du Maurier's and Kate Morton's, that kind of thing. That's just my personal preference, but I don't just live with that. I read a number of cozy mysteries, and that's a new endeavor, which I'll be happy to talk about because my husband and I are co-authoring a really neat cozy mystery series. But to get
jump
back
right
to
into that, yes.
Oh, jump right into that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Then be sure to bring me back to my reading preferences. My husband Jim and I, under the pen name of J.C. Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, wrote a cozy mystery series, and we were so lucky to land an amazing literary agent from Blue Ridge Literary Agency. And our first novel, Booked for Murder, is coming out this summer in June on mass market paperback, and it's available Kindle and Nook. And it takes place in a retirement community of Sun City West, Arizona, where my character, who is in her 40s, and she's an account clerk in Mankato, Minnesota, gets a call from her mother in Sun City West telling her that the ladies in the book club are all getting killed off mysteriously, and she believes it's a curse from the latest book they're reading, and she wants her daughter to fly out here and solve that curse. And the daughter says, well, why are you calling me? What on earth am I going to do? And the mother says to her, listen, Fee, you've been working for the Mankato Police Department for over a decade. Something must have rubbed off on you. And Fee says, yeah, over a decade in accounts receivable. I'm not a detective. But the mother nags and nags, and eventually the daughter flies out to Arizona to solve, you know, this book curse. And it's really an awful lot of hyperbole and humor, but again, the old-fashioned detective skills. You have to hunt down, you know, the clues and follow them. And we had such a good time writing that, of course, we jumped into the next one, which is Ditched for Murder, and then the third one, Staged for Murder. So they'll all be coming out eventually. But it's been interesting, and it's been a real learning experience because up until now, I've always written alone, and now writing with a partner is a challenge. First challenge being I like writing in first person. Jim likes writing in third person, but I won in this case. So the Sophie Kimball mysteries are going to be written. They are written, I should say. They are written in first person. But Jim's the one who comes up with the plot lines, the dialogue, the movement, the twists and turns. That's all him. And we work back and forth. We kind of toggle back and forth. So it's quite interesting. But it's, you know, it's a series of negotiating, whereas when you're a sole author, yeah, you're just working with yourself. So, you know, I've learned quite a bit as well, and I'm just thrilled to be doing this. It's just so much fun. But
what
the book
is your husband. Get back to your authors, because again, I'm intrigued. I co-write with a friend of mine, so I understand where you're coming from. We both write in first person in the book. She writes as her character, I write as my character. And then sometimes I go to, we go to third person when we're talking about the other character. And it's lots of fun. We do it long distance via email. But you have the opportunity of having your husband right there with you so y'all can bat about your characters and plot and circumstances over coffee. But what got him interested in wanting to join the literary world? I think it's fascinating.
Well, you know, living with someone who writes all the time, I was always sharing, you know, the time travel mysteries with him. And I noticed he'd say, well, you know, what if you had done this? What if, you know, that, or would it have worked out differently had such and such happened? And I would start, as I was writing, I would hand him what I was working on and say, well, what do you think? And he'd say, boy, this is moving slow. You know, I'd be falling asleep by now. This is what I would do if I were writing it. And he would plot out what he's doing. And I got to thinking, you know, maybe we should do something. And we just came up with the cozy mystery idea because living in this retirement community, the things we see, the things we hear, it's, you know, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, you truly cannot make this stuff up. So we get bits and pieces, and he's so funny. He'll listen to conversations, he'll get the general idea, he'll rewrite them in his mind and then on paper. And we've got a lot of fodder, and we said, hey, this is just too good to be true. We need to write about it. So that's how we wound up doing it.
That is hysterical. Don't forget to send me that link, because I'm going to be right there. I'm going to pre-order this, because it's a fun read. It's something that I can read at night before I go to sleep and not have to overthink it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that about going to sleep and not having to overthink it. I read all five of George R.R. Martin's Fire and Ice series, or people would know it as Game of Thrones. And I have to say, it wasn't always easy because the description and the names, but the imagery, the horrific. There's not even a word to describe the kinds of awful things that happen to people in those books. And I'd go to sleep at night with the worst horrific images in my mind, but I couldn't stop reading. And I can't wait till this. To be honest, I can't wait till this next book in that series comes out.
I'm absolutely ready. I'm ready to throttle the man, I'm going to tell you, because I finished all five books, and we were just into the third season of the series, and, of course, my husband got – I didn't even know who George R.R. Martin was until he started watching Game of Thrones.
Oh,
and
okay.
I didn't
Me
even
too.
Watch the first series because I'm thinking, I don't want to watch this. Well, I got hooked on it, so then I had to get the book. So
oh
now
gosh,
I have
you know,
to give, I have to
yeah,
give him
you,
a rundown.
You do.
Of who the characters are.
Well, oddly enough, I have not seen the series. I have it on disc. I've not seen it. I wanted to read the books first, and I have my own, this is a really funny story, I have my own impression of what the characters look like. So consequently, I did see one of them in a commercial, and not even knowing, I looked at that actor and I said, gosh, if I were casting, I'd cast him as Jon Snow. Well, oddly enough, it turned out he was.
Isn't that funny?
The last season
does not go via any of the books at all because he didn't have the last book written. So the last season is all screen written by writers. It's going to be amazing to see how well his book follows what the screen did. We'll see.
Should be very interesting.
Who else do you read that has influenced you in your writing? And again, has your, I know you like a certain genre, but you'll read just about anything, but have you found that on some level maybe your reading has evolved into other things that you never would have thought you would read?
Well, interestingly, I belong to a book club, so that has helped quite a bit because selections are made. There were authors I wouldn't have picked up ordinarily and found I really enjoyed. So that's been wonderful for me. But growing up, I grew up with Nancy Drew. I mean, who didn't? And the Hardy Boys. So Absolutely. That was my first introduction to mystery. But I loved Charles Dickens. I reread Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations whenever I can, believe it or not. But books and authors that I've really enjoyed, one of my favorites, and actually for a while it was in the eighth grade curriculum in Geneva, New York, is Robert McCammon's Boy's Life. And it's a coming-of-age story in the 1950s in Zephyr, Alabama. And it's also a mystery. And it's done so well in so many layers. It's truly a masterpiece. And it's Robert McCammon, and it's Boy's Life, and that's just stayed with me. And another similar one, although completely different, is a Western, and that's Larry Bjornson's Wide Open, which is about the settling of Abilene, Kansas. And I thought Westerns, I can take them or leave them. Well, this one I couldn't put down. And I thought if ever there was a reason to send me back to the classroom to put something in the curriculum, that would have been the book. And like I mentioned before, I like the moody gothic mysteries like Kate Morton's The House at Riverton and, of course, Rebecca, anything Daphne du Maurier. So those are some of my favorites. I'm really getting into the cozy mysteries because now that my husband and I are writing cozies, it's like, how can I describe it? Like somebody who is perhaps a chef, but you want to see what other chefs are cooking in their kitchens,
yeah,
so to speak. So we've been devouring a number of cozies with fantastic authors. We've discovered and we love Mary Marks, who writes quilting mysteries, Jen McKinley, Kathleen Bridge. There's just so many, and there's so many out there that are just wonderfully written and so much fun. That's for sure.
Well,
so consequently, I'm all over the place.
I understand that. You ought to see my house. I have bookshelves in every room in the house filled with books from educational material. I still have my college textbooks that I refer back to, which is frightening.
Wow.
To you name it, we've got it. Latin, French, Spanish, we have it. So anybody needs reference books, just hook. I can hook you up.
That's good. Oh, my gosh. But, Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, have you approached any of the school districts about using your books as their curriculum? Because I'm sitting here thinking, with the study aids in the back and the history that's involved and the time travel and the coming of age of these children that are not really adult, they're not really young, so they're that difficult in-between age and the things they can get into and sometimes the attitudes they have. What a beautiful thing it would be if you could get those in the schools.
Well, Lackawy, Missouri, which is this tiny, tiny little town, does have my books in their sixth grade curriculum. A number of libraries do, but it just depends. I was just very, very fortunate. It's a matter of this person knew that person, and that's what got it started. As far as books in schools, they're there, not necessarily in the curriculum, but certainly available to enhance the curriculum. So, for example, most sixth graders do study the Roman Empire, so the last tag would be, really a perfect adjunct to their studies, and some libraries do have that, so that, that does work out well, absolutely. But wherever I can, I do, and I do a number of workshops, too, for different school districts, different classes, about my books, about creating believable characters, mood in writing, elements of suspense, that kind of thing. And I also teach adult classes in Sun City Grand, Sun City West, this area. And it's been exciting to watch as people are devouring all this new information.
One of your things that you sent me, you said, my writing process, why being a pantser, in quotes, works for me. Explain.
Oh, my gosh. I am the quintessential pantser. That means writing by the seat of my pants. literally, some people can sit down and really write a very careful outline of a detailed outline of what they're going to write and how they're going to go about it. Recently, I heard Ann Perry speak, and that's exactly what she did. She said, "I have, you know, I take copious notes. I outline everything from page one, to, you know, throughout the book. But for me, I get a general idea, and my husband is the same way. So here are the two of us." And you know, we'll get started. We'll have a general idea of what's going to happen, and then we start adapting it. We'll get into the writing and we'll change things and adapt, and we'll kind of move it along. So I can't say that we're just going in blind. We will outline out a few chapters ahead, but I think it was E.L. Doctorow who said writing is like driving in the fog. As long as you can see ahead by your headlights, you'll be all right. Well, that's what it is for us, but some authors really do it orderly, sequentially. I'm not one of them.
Me either.
So that's
honey.
What
I'm
I meant by a pantser.
Like you, when the voices start screaming in my head, I just start writing, and if I decide I want to take it in one direction and they don't, we have an argument, and I always lose because if I don't listen to them, they go dark and the book just sits there and the computer screen blinks and goes, "Hey, stupid, you weren't listening. Hey, stupid, you want to open your head up again. Hey, stupid, nothing's going to get done till you listen to them." So, yeah,
well,
I understand that.
Oh, absolutely. When I was writing The Time Borrower, I had a real idea of where it was going and what was going to happen. And then midway through the book, I had this, what could best be described as an epiphany. And I said, you know what? I'm creating a twist, and it's happening right here and right now. And boom, I put it in, which just shook the whole thing up, and I think it made the book. And I don't want to say what it is because obviously I'll destroy it for readers, but it made all the difference. So even if I had been a very careful plotter, I still would have made that change. So it's just a matter of process. It's funny, in teaching the classes and even working with kids, people always say, well, what's the best way to go about doing this? And there is no best way. There's no one formula. Writing is such an in-depth and, well, an in-depth and personal experience. You have to be committed to the process. You have to have some idea of what you're writing. I mean, you can't just sit down and say, something will come to me. Well, we do have some ideas before we start. But definitely, there's no right or wrong, in the process. It just works differently for different authors, as well as the time when people write. I'm amazed at how many authors I know who write in the middle of the night. Well, my gosh, I can't even see the inside of my eyeballs in the middle of the night. I'm not going to get up at 2 in the morning and start writing. I don't know what I'll have.
My best time is early in the morning. Anything after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you can forget it because I'm brain stupid by that time.
Yep, and it's funny. Now, here in Arizona, in the summers, it gets to be really hot. It gets to be 110, 112. And you can't go outside after 12 noon, from like 12 noon to 6 o'clock at night. You walk outside at your own risk. I mean, people have a hard time understanding it, but even walking from the front door a few feet down to the mailbox, you feel as if you have been shoved into an oven and you're gasping for breath. So in the summertime, our best writing time literally is every afternoon. We get all our errands done first thing in the morning, turn up the air conditioning, turn up the fans, and for, 5 or 6 hours straight each day, that's our best writing time. The winters are kind of a flip-flop, a little different, but it just varies, and it's a matter of when you're most productive. But 2 and 3 in the morning is not my productive time, that's for sure.
Mine either. 2 or 3, I'm just going to sleep at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
Where can you be found?
Oh, golly. I have a couple of websites. Well, timetravelmysteries.com, timetravelmysteries.com is the website for the time travel novels. And J.C. Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, J.C. Eaton, author.com is the website for the cozy mysteries that are coming out. So we have two websites. One's mine, and then one is mine and my husband, since we are together, J.C. Eaton. And there's a Facebook page for J.C. Eaton, author, and there's a Facebook page for Time Travel Mysteries. So we can be found there as well. And right now on Time Travel Mysteries, people can sign up and they can get a newsletter. I try to get that out a couple of times a year. I don't like putting things out so often that people see it and say, oh, no, not another, you know, blurb from her, because people get inundated with all kinds of emails and offers and whatnot. But I do put out things when I think they're important or interesting or something readers would enjoy. But definitely we have a presence. I'm also on LinkedIn, Manic Reader, I'm on that. Pretty much, I think if you Google my name, you'll find me. And J.C. Eaton is just getting known because our release is going to take place in a few months. So hopefully we'll get the word out.
And what we need to do and what I want to do is, because this is a new endeavor, and like I told you before the show, I always bring my guests out back over and over again so that you can get a following here on the show. So do you have any new books coming out under your name before the J.C. Eaton book comes out in June?
No, no new books for me. Time Tracer came out last December, so it still needs to get known. And it's fun because the character's a 15-year-old gamer who'd rather be playing World of Warcraft than chasing after a serial killer. So I'm hoping that one hits the ground running as well. And that's not my most recent. The other novels, I've been pretty much lucky that they get a chance to get known, but they're all out there. So there's nine in all, so readers won't have a hard time finding them through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And sometimes Barnes & Noble has some of the Light Rider series in their stores, but then when they sell out, they're gone for quite a while till they come back, because I have a little publisher, not a big, big publisher for that particular series. But,
so I need to bring you back right as the book launches in June.
Oh, great.
So let me know. I don't have any dates that are taken up in June, so when you get a launch date or a pretty near launch date, let's get you back. I want to get you back before then because I think June is way too far out for you not to come back. I'd like to bring you back maybe in April and see where you are, see what's going on, even talk about the book, that's the new one that's coming out and what all is involved in it, and maybe even get your husband on one of the phones and let him call in too, and we'll just have an hour of J.C. Eaton.
Oh, my gosh, that would be wonderful. That would be great. And those books
are just
plain fun. that's
I can't wait to read them, I'm going to tell you. We've got maybe 4 or 5 minutes left. And in about a two-minute time limit, what advice would you give for a dreamer?
Oh, my gosh. First of all, don't let go of the dream. Obviously, if it's something that you want, then you have to make it your priority. Oftentimes, I come across people and they say, I want to write, but, oh, I just don't have the time. You have to make the time. If this is what you want, dreaming is one thing, but putting it into reality is another. There's all the sweat behind the product. That's for sure. It doesn't happen by itself. But if you don't have the dream, then, you don't have anything going. And I think people need to take their time, too. And by that I mean don't push yourself to crank out something before it's ready. Let it marinate. Think about it. Develop your ideas. Write them down. Don't lose them. And try to write each day. And little by little, pull those pieces together so you don't lose them. But if something matters to you, then the time you devote to that something needs to matter as well. And, boy, it's so easy today to be distracted. I can get on Facebook, and I can be distracted, and then I can look at all the things to the side. Oh, look, Zuilli has a new dress. Maybe it would look good on me. I doubt it, but maybe it would. And all of a sudden, you know, your mind is going to 100 different places when really you should be focused on what you're trying to accomplish. So, you know, that being said, having the dream is important, but, you know, working it and devoting the time to it really goes hand in hand. So hopefully that would work for people.
I would say that, well, I would also say that dreams are like anything else. It requires a self-discipline.
Yes, yes.
And if you're not willing to be self-disciplined, then you got to go out and find that first before you can. Your dream's not impossible. You just have to decide, okay, I have to discipline myself to do it. It's like getting up, brushing your teeth every day or putting your clothes on every day. Yes, it's mundane, but you got to do it every day in order to make that dream real.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting because I don't think many people, you know, really realize that, but when, you know, you hold a job, and we've all held jobs, you know, you report to work, you're either clocking in or walking in, or if you're a professional, however you're doing it, and you're at your job, your employment, your career, your profession, and you're there, it's your place of work, and you're accomplishing what you need to do. And yes, you have to be disciplined, but as a writer, time is your own, and you have to set it up. You know, do I want to get up in the morning and close the door at 9 o'clock and tell myself from 9 to noon I'm going to be writing? Or, you know, if I just leave it and say, well, you know, maybe I'll write for 5 minutes, you're not going to get anywhere. So that self-discipline is so, so important. And as I said, you know, there's so many distractions out there. I turn off my cell phones so I don't have them, and I just work at it. My husband is he's different. He can just ignore anything going on, seriously, around him. I mean, Ringling Brothers can bring in the circus, and he doesn't care. If he's writing, if he's, you know, cranking out some ideas, it can all go on in front of him, and it doesn't matter. Me, I need absolute quiet, absolute concentration. So it's interesting, but that self-discipline does matter. It really does.
And ladies and gentlemen, as I say on at the end of every show, that if it were not for dreamers, we would not have a civilization as we know it. It is the dreamers that have created the trips to the moon. It is the dreamers that have created the electricity. It is the dreamers that have put pen to paper and put it in print. It is the dreamers that have created the telephone and the internet and the fashion designs, even the fashion designs that we wear. It's the dreamers. It's the artists, it's the writers, it's the musicians that have created our society as we know it. So the next time someone says, what are you doing, dreaming? Say, yes, I am. But it's like Anne said, make that dream real, and in order to do that, you have to have discipline. Even some of the greatest artists in the world who were thought to be insane were disciplined. Miss Anne, I want to thank you for being on my show tonight, and as soon as we get off from here, we'll set up the next show. Ladies and gentlemen, start following Anne on this show. Tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, we have Miss Gray Dixon, who is an author. And Saturday night at 8 o'clock, we have an author friend of mine who I've known for the last, God forever, how many years, 50-some-odd years. His name is Alan Gravett. He and I graduated high school together, and he has been a busy man. So, Miss Anne, thank you so much, my dear, for
taking a pleasure. Yvonne, thank you. I'm just thrilled to be on the show. And I want to thank all the folks behind me and my husband who have helped us out behind the scenes in so many ways, because we couldn't have done it without you, and you know who you are. So thanks so much. And Yvonne, I appreciate it. I look forward to coming back.
Well, you're quite welcome. And hang on just a minute. As soon as the show goes dark, because we'll chat for just a minute. I don't like to just hang up on my guest as soon as the show's over. So ladies and gentlemen, what I always say at the end of every show, love yourself, like yourself, and be happy. dream and make it real. Until tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, this is Off the Chain. This is your host, Yvonne Mason. Okay, the show is now off the air, but anything we talk about goes into archives so folks can listen at it. But what I did want to reiterate is thank you so, so very much for being on my show and taking an hour out of your busy day. It's very appreciative on my part.
Oh, my gosh. I want to thank you. It was wonderful. I'm so glad to get out there and you know, hopefully introduce readers to the Goldfarb and the Eaton novels. So that's great. Oh, Yvonne,
well,
you were wonderful. It was such a pleasure.
Well, thank you, sweetheart. The hour flies by because we get,
oh, it does.
You know how we, like I said, the show's not scripted, even though I have notes, but we go off on all these little different paths. But what I did want to tell you is I am going to introduce your books to a friend of mine who homeschools her children. She lives in California.
Oh, my God.
And I'm going to
tell
her about them being the time travel historical novels with the study aids in the back and get her to get those for her children who are still in school. She's been homeschooling her kids since I think the first one was born. The first one's 18 now, and she's got five or six kids. So,
wow.
These would be excellent books for her. And then I'm going to ask her to friend you. Her name is Melissa Green.
Okay.
And to hook up with you so that you can let her know when you get ready to release new books and all that good stuff. Because I think
absolutely.
The children would really, really enjoy these books. And like I told you before the show will go into archives. When it goes into archives, I'm going to put the link up on Facebook and I'll tag you in it. And then I will download the show and put it up on all these podcasts. And when they upload on the podcast, I will put the link on Facebook, and I will also tag you in it. And what I would love for you to do is take these shows and put them on your web pages, spread them all over your network, and use them as a tool in getting yourself out there.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much. This is wonderful. And I'll be sure, you know, to go on and message you and send you that link. And if your friend Melissa goes to the Time Travel Mysteries website, she can pull up each novel, and it gives the synopsis. There's a storyboard there, so she can follow it through. And even if she went on Amazon, they have this search inside the book feature. So I always tell readers, pull it up and go into search inside the book and see how you like it. See what the flow is like. See if it interests you. That's really important. So that would be great. But I do have a number of schools that read the books, and kids really like them. So that would be great.
All right. Well, let me get off from here and get back to I have more than one office in this house. I have my radio studio, and then I have my office in the other room. So let me get off from here and send you some dates in April and in June for you to come back and get hold of Melissa and have her friend you, and then I'm going to look up the link and send her the link and tell her what I found out about your books and how wonderful they are and the study guides. I've never heard of study guides in the back of a book. I love it.
Oh,
yeah.
Got really detailed, good study guides. She'd like them.
And then I'm going to send her your Facebook link and tell her to friend you so that she can keep up with you as you keep releasing new books.
Oh, that sounds great. I really appreciate it.
All right, my dear.
This was such a fun night. Thank you so much, Yvonne. Have a great evening. We'll be in touch.
All right, darling.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.